in today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Hey, I have COVID right now. We worked together. You should go get checked.
Agricultural workers battling COVID and capitalism in California's Central Valley.
That there are 14 Black men standing up for what they believe in and fighting for their dignity.
Striking New Orleans sanitation workers get support from the International Longshore Workers Union, teachers, and other workers in Tacoma, Washington.
Well, because my parents, James and Carrie Glover, became matured citizens within the framework of the post office.
And we'll hear from actor and activist Danny Glover about his postal family in defense of a publicly funded postal service. This is Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates focused on COVID-19 and the many ways in which this pandemic touches people's lives. I'm your host, Nana Jumphy. Labor Day 2020 is one of catastrophe for millions of U.S. workers, with mass unemployment of over 30 million people, loss of health care, privatization, a pandemic threatening our lives, families, and communities, mass evictions, and a climate emergency. All of this is in a context of an ever-growing movement against racism and murderous police and opposition to a president whose rhetoric encourages white supremacist terror. On this Labor Day 2020, we'll look at these issues and lift up the voices of working people. Facing possible COVID-19 contamination on the job, New Orleans City waste workers rebelled and demanded personal protective equipment and $15 an hour in May of this year. In solidarity with the all-Black sanitation workers on strike in New Orleans, ILWU workers in Tacoma, Washington are picketing True Blue Incorporated every Thursday at noon until the company negotiates in good faith, meets the strikers' demands, and recognizes the city waste union.
They're dealing with toxic waste every day, and they always rush us on the clock. They call us out here. We work from 4:10, 4:20 in the morning, all the way to like 4:00 in the evening for $10.25 an hour. You know, that's been going on. We get paid late. Everything is just bad here. They just need to fix it.
My name is Daytrion Wilk, and I'm the City Waste Union representative. So on May 5th of 2020, there were 14 striking sanitation workers. At the time, it was about 30 people collectively came together and decided to go on strike because they were asking for better working conditions, $15 per hour as a living wage, $150 per week in hazard pay. We're also asking for PPE, and now we've changed that demand to better distribution of PPE, because at the time the guys were being paid $10.25. They were having issues with trucks that were spewing, or if it rained outside, they would just have to work their whole route soaking wet. Another concern of theirs was that during a pandemic where these guys are already in hazardous conditions, now they're having to be bare hand touching the trash of a home that could possibly be infected with the coronavirus. And this was a huge concern, especially in the city of New Orleans, because 16 weeks ago, there was a surge of coronavirus cases and people were literally dropping dead in their homes and all over the city. And it was a huge concern. We're pretty sure at least 75% of the hoppers that are currently on strike at some point were unknowingly infected with the coronavirus just due to working conditions and just the hazardous nature of their jobs. So their strike just made their already concerns just totally urgent.
And I'm Jonathan Edward. For us, being hands-on with it by the coronavirus of the COVID-19 or whatever they calling it, by us never actually paying a full attention to the coronavirus and just constantly working, keeping the community clean, and just hearing the things and watching the news and just seeing the uprise of the numbers of the coronavirus and things. So that would solidify it for us to go ahead and decide to go on strike, because we went on strike May 5th and the coronavirus started, they say, before Mardi Gras. That's what led up to the May 5th and all the guys coming together.
Okay, Gabriel Prawl, Vice President of ILO-52. Sanitation workers going on strike. I decided that we're going to look in for some more. So they told us they was going to do it, and they did it, you know. And it was very courageous, I can tell you this, because not many workers right now in New Orleans are standing up for unionized decent wages, you know. Because even as the sanitation workers are asking for $15 an hour, I think they still underpay for the condition, for the risk, and for the hazard that they got to deal with. Especially in the 21st century, they should not be making that kind of money. They should be making union wages.
I'm Leith Call, longshoreman in the Port of Seattle. These garbage workers had gone on strike, and they were being replaced by prison labor. Prison labor doing the being forced by their parole officers to do this work in prison flips, or else be told it would be put on their parole file that they refused a job and they'd be less likely to ever get parole. So essentially slave labor in direct violation of Article 4 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
It's been an issue for not even just the sanitation workers, but it's been an issue for workers in the city of New Orleans overall. They've privatized power. They've privatized working directly for the city of New Orleans. Everything here is contracted out. So what happens, at least for our sanitation workers in this situation, is they're two steps removed from the city being responsible for anything that happens to them. The city will say, well, we contract that work out. And then going to Metro and saying, oh, well, we have a problem. Metro would say, technically, you're not our employee. None of our employees are on strike. Only PeopleReady employees are on strike. And PeopleReady is the company that actually technically hires and houses or writes out the checks as a joint employer with Metro. So it's caused a huge problem. I think it's a huge part of the systemic racism that happens in this country. And it is a constant shackling of Black and brown people, Black and brown men and women, to a system not made to empower us.
Well, for me, it's just for my dignity and respect as a man, you know, being too old to be getting paid too less, no benefits. I hurt my arm, my pinky or something. I'm coming out of my pocket with $250 for no copay. That's just to see a doctor and for them to run, you know, the EKG and check your temperature and all that. Not to see it, I'm going to the back, and you know, that's another bill. So, you know, two, three jobs, like they try and say it, but you know, for me, it's just my dignity and respect.
100 and some days I went on a strike, and I'm African American myself. It's like, it's no color. It's like every gender. It's like we've been getting support from all over. I'm hopeful. I mean, we've been on a strike, 16, 17? You know, we might have thought it was gonna be 17 hours. It ended up being 17 weeks. And that point about the 1025, you know, we can't live on that. I was just telling someone the other day, if my son start working with me right now, and I've been hopping for over 20 years, him and I would be making the same thing, because that's the one job that you don't get no raise. You already don't get no benefit.
People are tired. So start having the conversations. Have the conversation with your neighbor, with your mama, with your uncles. Talk to everybody you can about what's happening so people can see that there are 14 Black men standing up for what they believe in and fighting for their dignity. So go to True Blue's office, ask them if they know what's going on in New Orleans, have the conversations, ask people if they know what's happening to not just the sanitation workers, but to the working class, because time is up.
This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Nana Jumphy. We now hear from actor and activist Danny Glover, who talks to producer Steve Zeltzer about his post office family and the ongoing effort to privatize the publicly funded postal service.
Certainly, I'm very fond of the post office. First of all, because my parents, James and Carrie Glover, became matured citizens within the framework of the post office. They became involved in the postal union. At that time, it was a very strong union comprised of African Americans primarily. My parents came to the post office in 1948, a young couple who had only been married for 3 years, and they came to the post office. And it was an opportunity for us to work toward having a middle class lifestyle. You take now, when I moved on my block, there were five people who worked at the post office who had had their homes for a considerable amount of time, and they worked with the post office. They worked with my parents. They knew my parents. There were actually five people on this block who knew my parents because of the post office. You know, when I came to the Model Cities Program in the Office of Community Development in 1971, there were people in the Bayview Hunters Point who knew my parents, and they moved, and they were organizers in the community.
This Louis DeJoy, the Postmaster General appointed by Trump, there were hearings, and he is apparently ordered the shutdown of machines, dismantlement of machines. He's preventing overtime so that veterans and people who are getting medications through the post office now are waiting. Their lives may be in danger. What is going on? I mean, it seems like this is threatens millions of people, their health and safety, and as well as whether or not we can have an election with the post office.
Well, certainly, we know that more people, because of the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, are looking to use the mail voting. Use mail as a source of voting during the election. I think the idea of it creates a great deal of uncertainty and chaos and certainly fear. I think there's a great deal of fear among those people who are afraid that their voice will not be heard at the ballot box this November with the election. And possibly that there are a number of things that happen. As you pointed out also, people receive medication. We look at Amazon, the incredible growth of Amazon, the incredible growth of other forms that are private, that are own and controlled within the private space. This is a public space. It's always been a public space. It's been in a fight for it to retain itself, maintain itself as a public space.
You see hope, I mean, of the people being able to overcome this, I would say, historic crisis that we're facing that humanity really hasn't faced. I mean, 100 years ago, with the pandemic in San Francisco and around the country and around the world, we didn't have the technology which we have now, but it seems we're in the same situation. People refusing to wear masks, this right-wing ideological challenge to science. I mean, it seems like we're facing some fundamental tasks in our future of humanity, really.
You talk about one of the greatest existential dangers that we face now is if climate change and global warming. We just, every day there's a new report. That's how right. Masses of ice up in the North Pole have broken away and certainly will cause the rise in sea levels, et cetera, et cetera. We cannot underestimate the impact that that's had on. But it happens in the global south first. It happens because it finds its way in terms of refugee, the number of refugees, but also the ongoing wars. It also caused the refugee crisis, the greatest refugee crisis since the end of World War II. and also the uncertainty that exists now around that. You know, I've been in places where there are places now that their families have been moving as refugees for a decade or more. They're still unsettled. You know, does that become, in a modern world, how do we handle that? You know, how do we handle that without some enormous distribution of wealth? Some more of the change in how we run this world, you know, how this world is run under this paradigm. But it's been run under this paradigm in some shape or form. We don't have like 2 billion people on the planet in 1934. We have 8 billion people on the planet. You know, 40% of those people live on less than $2 a day. So people are still in harm's way with climate change, with the issues around destabilization and displacement because of conflict, internal conflict, and certainly war. All those things are real. But we sit up here, right here, experiencing those issues, and we do experience it. We're looking right down in Louisiana right now. We're experiencing climate change. Yes, we might have the resources in some sense to counter that climate change momentarily, or to shift the emphasis from what is really happening. But at the same thing, it has happened. Imagine that 10 times fold in places like India, and where we have a crisis. Vandana Shiva has talked about the crisis of small farmers in India who have committed suicide over the past decades because they have no longer have any control of the seeds that they've planted for generations and generations and generations. It's owned by Monsanto, you know, and other kind of entities. So there's some kind of way in which we have to talk about all these things and see them as a collective issue, that only for the what we think about a food and food redistribution and here, but also in the world itself, especially in the world. The pandemic, we did very little news and very little information on how the pandemic has affected Africa. And we know how it's affected certainly India and other places in there, in Pakistan, you know. So I think those are the things that have to be on our table. If we're gonna really talk about a real serious platform for change, it has to have a level of internationalism and taking into account what is happening in the rest of the world, not simply just what is happening to us here.
That was Danny Glover speaking to producer Steve Zeltzer. Now, comedian Lee Camp on how Amazon accidentally posted a job opening to monitor labor organizing activity.
Every once in a while, corporations that rule over us will accidentally tell the truth. You know, they'll accidentally say the quiet part loud. And Amazon has done that. Amazon put up a job hiring for a security analyst, and specifically within the details of what the job would be, it was monitoring labor organizing threats. In the past couple of days, once there was a stink, people were raising about the fact that Amazon was publicly trying to hire someone to monitor labor organizing threats. Amazon has now deleted the posting. All told, the point is that these companies, they become the most successful by realizing how to most effectively exploit the worker. And this job posting that they put up was it to monitor labor organizing threats, meaning any sign of someone saying maybe we should unionize. Maybe. And if you take away the scary word union, which, you know, the right wing has done a great job making everyone scared to death of the word union. If you take that word away, if workers were to be talking about, hey, let's get together and we all say we demand a paid sick day. And Amazon would find out if that's happening. And then they have various ways of dealing with it. They have, a famous anti-union training video leaked out.
While employees have the right to organize, if you see warning signs of potential organizing, notify your building HRM and GM site leader immediately. Some signs are less obvious than finding the actual union flyer, but they can still indicate associate disengagement, which is itself a warning sign for potential organizing.
Unions are bad. I heard they give you chlamydia.
That was comedian Lee Camp. Stay with us.
How well I do remember how class struggle brought me through. I went out on strike in 32. And they brought the thugs against me and the state militia too. And they kicked me in the gutter. How about you? How about you? How about you? Can't you see this system's rotten through and through? It gives millions to the bosses, the capitalistic few, but enslaves the toiling masses like me and you. We need a brand new system, that's one thing that is true. A boss will have to work like me and you. And we'll all have homes to live in and a job to work at too. But there'll be no boss to rob us, me and you. How about you? How about you? Can't you see this system's rotten through and through? It gives millions to the bosses, the capitalistic few, but enslaves the toiling masses like me and you.
Everyone is equally affected by the coronavirus pandemic. Large corporations are reaping benefits from trillion-dollar bailouts and buyout mom-and-pop shops. They do so while continuing to exploit immigrant labor. Mexican immigrants are perhaps the most numerous among the low-wage workforce. They are called essential workers, but less hypocritical capitalists refer to them as disposable, as easily replaceable workers. Independent producer Dave Adelson from Los Angeles, California, takes it from here.
This is Dave Adelson in Los Angeles for Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I spoke by phone with Hugo Castro, a field organizer with the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights in LA, or CHIRLA.
CHIRLA is a coalition for humane immigration rights, LA. It was based in LA. It started in LA 1986. And in my case, I'm organizing in the southern border, San Diego County, Imperial Valley County, Tijuana, and Mexicali, also with our deported brothers and sisters, and also with U.S.-born kids and children and youth who are living the deportation with their parents. It's really tough for migrant populations because they are victims of forced migration, first of all, in the past. All people have migrated because of economic violence, but now they are experiencing direct violence in their country and in their homeland, and it's very sad because they are going through a surviving mode, always under stress, and it's sad because not only them but also their children are going through that situation, and we have to understand that we are totally wrong. The government is basing dignity and humanity and legality in a piece of paper. We are more than that. You know, you are a U.S. citizen, you have more rights, born, you are naturalized a little bit less, then you have a green card a little bit less, and you have a visa, tourist visa, worth less, and you have that a new economic slave visa, the 2HA, you have less, and you are undocumented, you are totally less, even you are treated worse than a pet. You can go to jail because you treat wrong a cat or a dog. However, people are beating up in undocumented migrants and nobody cares. You know, we have to change that. We have to break paradigms. Our minds have been blurred but a lot of hate promoted, especially for the by the one that is right now seated at the White House. You know, it's like he's possessive, and he's spreading all the hate and all the fear against the undocumented migrants.
You had told me something about your own family experience dealing with that kind of hate in the past.
Yes, I was. You can notice that English is my second language, even though I was born in the States. I'm a first generation Mexican American. My dad was a bracero worker, but when we were kids in Salinas, California, where I grew up, where I was born, the neighbors were from the Hell Angels. And there were a lot of violence against my family, and you know, and it, to a point that a farm worker, really dear friend of my dad, who was like or grandpa, he was threatened with a knife in the throat by this racist. Since that occasion, my mom decided to move the family to relocate to Mexicali. And so I know about it. You know, I know my family have, you know, suffered from hate since we were kids. And to a point that I say, ya basta, that's enough. We have to shame it. We cannot be dealing with this stuff, with this crap that these hate promoters are making people to think that actually you are less human. You don't have a piece of paper. You know, people are dying right now.
If you could imagine a better situation for the migrant population that we might possibly arrive at, what would that be and how would we get there?
The ideal situation, a humane immigration reform for all the undocumented international workers. They are not illegals. They are international workers, and they have the knowledge, that experience, and they should be treated with respect. Also, we have to change the immigration policy because they are immoral laws. People can be detained up to 10 years for illegal reentry just because they want to go back with their loved ones in the States. And it have to end. It have to end. We have to think about families, the psycho-emotional damage that the system is creating. So this is a war. I see it as a war because I live it, because I am with them. I am at the border, and I have been at the border since 2003. November the 20th, 2003 is when I actually got out of jail. I started to help in 2002 when I was serving time for something that now is legal, and I pay more than the average because I'm brown. I graduated from university. I should be seated as a role model with 23 units in 4.0, four times in this list of honor students, even in jail. But I'm brown. And so we have to stop that double standards. The brown people, the black people, the immigrants, the Muslims have to be treated with respect. And the first step is to not base dignity and humanity in a piece of paper. We have to end it. It's not a dream. It is possible. This you know, the inhumane treat against migrants didn't start with Trump. You know, this is something that started in 1986. And worse, I experienced during Obama. I voted for Obama, but I witnessed, I did research in 2010 when I was helping start an organization, Angels Without Borders in Mexicali, Hotel Migrante. Imagine three buses every night from 1 a.m. to 3 a.m., three buses loaded of Americans in their mind being deported for the first time, back kicked out, like trash, to Mexico. And I was there. We were guiding them, trying to protect them from the police, trying to protect them from the organized crime. So this is nothing new. But But it is getting worse. It's getting worse because Trump is really good at marketing. He's a businessman, and he is good at marketing. He sold an inhumane terrorist protocol as a migrant protection protocol, but he's actually creating terror in Mexico. He's worse than Obama in this case that he actually promotes more hate. But in the Democratic Party also, there's a lot of conflict of interest. We have to understand that a nation cannot be run as a business. The United States have been becoming like a corporation, not like a nation. It's serving the interest of just the 1%, not serving the interest of the people, the 99. We have to change it.
Can you talk a little bit about how the pandemic has impacted the migrants and what the prospects are for them to be able to deal with the multiple crises they're facing?
It is facing worse for the essential workers, the ones that are farm workers, that now, for instance, in California, there's no way that there's no protection for the safe distance between each other. You know, they are working hand by hand, and also they are being transported in buses overcrowded, and there's no protection for them. The United States is avoiding the responsibility of protecting refugees, and is throwing the responsibility to Mexico, that which Mexico doesn't get the responsibility, and it is got by the humanitarian activists such as all the ones who are running the shelters, including myself. And they are suffering because there are not enough donations that go through, because both government don't help the refugees, and the refugees are trapped without education because they cannot go to school, and all the rest are living in a limbo stage. Many of them are getting sick. For instance, in Tijuana, four shelter directors got sick from COVID, and three in Mexicali, and a lot of migrants and refugees were also going through these hardships. At what point is the responsibility of the U.S. government, because they are asking for asylum and they are being sent back to Mexico, where many of them have been assaulted and some of them have been killed? So where's the responsibility as a brothers keepers of the world, as a land of the free? That's a question for all good Americans. Well, on this Labor Day, we should think about the most vulnerable ones, the essential workers that are putting their life in risk and are saving lives. Because with COVID, you have probably the 5% probability of dying because of COVID, but you have 100% probability of dying because of hunger. And our people, nuestra gente, are putting food on your table. At least treat them with dignity.
This is Dave Adelson in Los Angeles for Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I spoke by phone with Hugo Castro, a field organizer with the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights in L.A., or CHIRLA. You can find out more about their work online at CHIRLA.org.
There is a growing coronavirus pandemic in California's Central Valley, where much of the world's agricultural products are grown and processed. We interview actor and community activist Ramon Real, who discusses his and other activist efforts to prevent the expansion of the pandemic since March 2020.
Now, the Central Valley is one of the biggest hotspots for COVID right now. The numbers of COVID has spiked drastically, and the County of Merced had an agreement with Foster Farms that they're not going to shut it down. And so there's this back and forth of, wait, so is it going to, is it not going to be, are the CDC guidelines going to be implemented? What are the rules and regulations that are going into this? And the responses that we get are not from any official folks, but rather than workers themselves. And the things that are happening within, according to the workers that have reported, is that They are working 3 to 4 like feet apart. They're not having the social distance. They're not doing scattered rotations of shifts to then minimize contact with folks. If people are getting sick in certain departments, no one is told about it. They instead keep it as a secret. And then, they keep it hidden, right? They keep it hidden from the folks. And so what happens is that these folks and these workers have to then utilize some sort of like phone system, right? To then call their coworker, who then will call their coworker and call their coworker. That way they're trying to trace like, hey, I have COVID right now. We worked together. You should go get checked. And that's how they're attempting to kind of protect themselves, because the company is not doing any of this. The company instead is coercing them to go back into work, threatening them that they will lose their job if they don't present themselves to work, even though they have a doctor authorization not to go in. And that's just a component. The rest of workers who are still there, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of people who are terrified. They're very anxious and having anxiety attacks, because you're going into work for your own death. Like, they're sending you into your own death. They're not cleaning these facilities. They're not following the guidelines. So it's like, what are they doing to help these workers? It's flabbergasting. It's appalling. And quite frankly, it's even worse that the administration stepped in and actually ruled in favor of Foster Farms. When we're asking for help from our government to say, hey, can you help us out? Because your people that feed you are dying. And the response that we got was that that Foster Farms is going to continue to stay open, right? They always say you're a dispensable employee. Like, we have a huge or a ton amount of people wanting to work. And so that is always one of the biggest rebuttals and counterpoints that these employers have, is threatening the workers with their employment. So then they're coerced into going into work, regardless of how scared they are, regardless of whether they're sick or not. And that's not okay. It's absolutely criminal.
And Governor Newsom has been asked about Cal OSHA.
We have the responsibility to do that. That's OSHA's job foundationally, was pre-pandemic, certainly is as we work our way through this pandemic.
What do you think Governor Newsom is? Do you think he really is become a representative of the bosses, of the billionaires who own these companies? Because he obviously has been told there's serious problems. There have been letters by the Sacramento Labor Council for Latin American Advancement, by the Cal Fed, by over 70 organizations begging him to fully staff OSHA, including hiring 1,000 OSHA inspectors. There are 18 million workers in California, and they're facing the frontline workers particularly, of this epidemic.
We're in September now. We're nearing towards the end of the year, and there has been no action. The thing with the Central Valley is that the Central Valley is usually seen as the of California. And so we actually produce the majority of the nation's food. We produce, I believe it's a third of the nation's food and 99% of the nation's nuts and certain fruits. So we're the number one producer of dairy, aside from cheese, because that's Wisconsin. But we produce so much. We are the folks that feed the United States. Yet we are the folks that are not getting the help that we need to live, to keep working, to keep feeding the American people. What I don't understand is that folks are ruling things without being here to see what is actually happening, because they're just seeing monetary gain and product and what is being produced. But you're not seeing what is happening within these buildings. You're not seeing what is happening to these workers. You're not seeing who are the people who are sick, who are handling our food. And it's not just the food that goes out to the stores. It's food that goes out to hospitals, that goes into schools. Well, schools are kind of shut down right now, but still it's like they go into schools, hospitals, prisons. It's more than just the food that we get in the stores. And so from what I know, Newsom has put a freeze on hiring. But right now, on top of the unemployment rate that we have, we would absolutely benefit from having more Cal OSHA employees. Staff it up. Get some more folks up in here. It'll help the unemployment rate right now. It'll help people who are at home, unemployed, who are struggling to meet payments, because they're also, there's a huge thing that's happening with unemployment that only 5% of calls have been answered or received. And one of the biggest things that we are seeing is language discrimination. Any type of information that is given is in English. Even if the information is seldom, it is in English with no translations. And from the reports that we're getting from employees is that they're sometimes made to sign documents that are not interpreted, they're not translated, they don't know what it is that is that they're signing, right? And so there is a huge advantage that they're taking, they as in the employers, and they're taking advantage of the employees' language barrier, right? They're utilizing that as a way to exploit these workers and as a way to manipulate them.
That was actor and community activist Ramon Real speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. Stay with us. We'll be back after a short break.
Tierra en las uñas, sol en la cara, bolsa en la espalda porque pesa la carga, callos en las manos, sangre en los pies, caminando dos horas porque aquí no hay tren. El choclo se cosecha, le da sombra al poroto, semillas en la tierra y ojalá que llueva pronto. Quizás le dicen loco porque vive de la tierra, el camino pa' su hogar se ilumina con estrella, pero él se quiere ir lejos de aquí. Camino norte to the land of the free. La cosa han cambiado, todo lo compraron. United States, United Fruit y Monsanto. Tratado de comercio, cambiar el universo que dejaron los ancestros. Solo hechos, todavía falta techo. Todavía hay alegría, alegre rebeldía que se vive día a día.
Esa tierra no se vende, no se rinde, se trabaja, se organiza en un frente. Populares de la calle, apoyando el que trae comida a nuestros hogares. Ahora bajo rayos solares, condiciones poco humanas. La maniobra es barata, un variable matemático para asegurar la ganancia. Pero ellos no me ganan, tengo más ganas. La memoria, la historia me hace creer en mañana. Hasta la victoria nos dijeron, no cederemos el terreno. No aceptamos el imperio del desierto, no lo tenemos. La copa de mojale, tomate, azúcar, café. El corto quizás no se ve, el obrero explotado, el rico acomodado, el resto mal informado. Así mantienen calmado la masa, comida hecha en casa, semilla fabricada, contaminada, quieren matar a Pachamama.
This is COVID, Race and Democracy. I'm Nana Jumphy. Massive worker strikes have been taking place in Belarus against the government of President Alexander Lukashenko, who has served as president of this ex-Soviet republic since the establishment of the office 26 years ago. Lisa Merliak, international secretary of the Belarus Independent Trade Union, spoke with Pacifica about how the COVID-19 pandemic has fueled the mass protests.
In 2017, there was a law on those who don't have job. Those who are jobless, they're not getting money from the state, but they're supposed to pay the money to the state for having no job. And they're called social parasites. It arose a lot of protest in the country in 2017, then in 18. Then in 2019, with the outbreak of COVID-19, when the government chose a strange strategy to struggle with it, saying that it doesn't exist, that it is our fantasy, this is our psychosis, in a way. A lot of ordinary Belarusians understood that they were on their own. And they started to organize many initiatives, trying to help each other, trying to help the medical workers with the health and safety measures, like trying to sew masks, making protective screens, sewing special clothes for the doctors, because the doctors were not provided by the state or by the Ministry of Health with all this equipment. And I think that These several months that we had of COVID-19 in Belarus made a lot of people voluntarily be active. And as soon as the elections were announced, many people mobilized and actually thought that they might bring some change to the country. And
do they call themselves socialist in Belarus? Does the government say that this
no,
is
they don't.
Socialism? No.
No. What we live in can be called a state capitalism, and the state is totalitarian.
If you have a are able to get rid of Lukashenko, what kind of country do people want to see? What? How would they want to see the country organized for the working people and the people of the country?
Again, I can't say for the whole population. What people want is freedom. But normally we see a lot of examples that freedom comes with more unfairness to workers and with less rights and so on. So we as unions, we hope that we will have time and place to create such structures that would struggle with the new government. Like we believe that the new government that might come would be neoliberal and some populist. They would talk about freedom, and on the background of this freedom, they might bring privatization, they might sell whatever our land and so on. And we as unions, we are afraid of this thing. However, I can't say that the workers are thinking of it at the moment. Because what we think of at the moment is how to get rid of this regime, which is also not providing anything good for the population. So the first common thing we have to do is to fight the regime, and then we have to think about what country we want at the same time, and we will not stop fighting even after the regime is gone.
You see this pandemic as what it created, a crisis where people began to question who was in charge and whether or not they were representing the people and the working class in Belarus?
Yeah, true. the main issue over COVID and people being angry with the state was that the state was humiliating people, really, like naming them very bad names, actually. Yeah, so many people first, they were humiliated by this, and then they understood that the state doesn't show the numbers. I mean, they were hiding the numbers of those who were newly infected each day. Then they were hiding the numbers of the deceased. They were hiding the numbers of those who are on artificial ventilation of lungs. I mean, we couldn't get any information. We just knew that many people were dying, though it was written in the death certificates that they died of some other disease. And COVID was very rare to be there. So this showed that this system is lying all the time. And this time it was lying about life issues, which were important for each family. It was not a political issue of some activists, you know. It was everywhere. It was invisible, like this virus, and many people were horrified with what is going on. So maybe this thing mobilized a lot of people. They started to mistrust state media, and they started to trust independent media more. And really many people got applications of those Telegram, Viber, whatever, all those applications that we are using at the moment, and Zoom, and everyone was communicating with their families. Many Belarusians live abroad. Many Belarusians are migrants in many countries. And this virus can't be stopped by borders. Thinking of us Belarusians who are trying to build our own future now at the moment by slowing production, by protesting every day, by not agreeing to do what the government wants from us. And I'm sure that in the nearest future, we might get even poorer than we were before. But we are doing it for our children. We are doing it for our future. And we want to see Belarus a different country very soon. And I hope that it comes very soon. However, it looks like it's going to be a long way, actually.
That was Lisa Merliak, International Secretary of the Belarus Independent Trade Union. And finally, athlete and activist Craig Hodges discusses sports and politics on The Collision with host Dave Zirin from WPFW in Washington, D.C.
We have just one of my absolute sports heroes, one of my heroes at the intersection of sports and politics, an absolutely legendary figure in this space. Once-time NBA player, full-time activist, full-time freedom fighter, Craig Hodges. What makes you think that this, why this was a breaking point for so many NBA players? I mean, do you think it was just being in that bubble and feeling isolated from what's happening in the streets?
I think it's a compilation, man, of being in the bubble, seeing the struggles that are going on, and seeing the atrocities that are being committed. And almost having, you know, it was amazing to me initially when they talked about, yeah, you can go in the bubble and that's going to magnify your platform. And I'm like, nah, that's not going to magnify the platform. What that's going to do is basically going to distract everybody's attention away from the issues.
Yeah, I don't know if you said the WNBA players came out right after the NBA players said they wouldn't be playing. And, you know, they both took a knee during the anthem and then they left the court. The WNBA players have been leading on this too from jump.
No question about it, man. And I just look at it, you know, we stop and we look at our sojourn in America, whether you want to take it from the African side or the Native American side, you know, the oppression is, you know, the sisters have been more oppressed than anybody, man. So when I see the rise of black women in politics and sport and seeing the leadership role that they're taking, you know, that's the type of that's leadership that you can follow because you know it's taking you in the right direction and how can you help it? So that's been my position over the last, really since this whole COVID thing went down, is that, you know, I've been, you know, partnering with sisters and seeing how I can be of service because they are the real backbone in this nation when we stop and when we're talking about work stoppage. If we consider all over America, not that brothers have taken a somewhat title and exemplary role and example of work stoppage, now we might be able to ask our sisters who go into, like where I'm at, I'm in Chicago right now. From the south suburbs of Chicago, the train that runs downtown Chicago, if the sisters didn't get on the train or public transportation to go into the city, it was shut down, man. And that's basically all over America. With black women decided to have a work stoppage, there are whole new paradigms that have to come into play.
Craig Hodges speaking to Dave Zirin on Pacifica Radio, WPFW's The Collision, Sports and Politics. This concludes today's Labor Day edition of COVID, Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network and its affiliate stations across the United States. Today's show was produced by Steve Zeltzer and Polina Vasiliev. The show's executive producers are Akua Holt, Steve Zeltzer, and Polina Vasiliev. Verna Avery Brown is our executive consultant. I've been your host, Nana Jumphy. Visit our website at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org for the full interviews with Danny Glover, Craig Hodges, and all the other guests featured in this broadcast. Thanks for listening.